It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Here in Iowa, we know all too well what can happen to a small town when the main source of local jobs shuts down or moves out. That's what happened in Crosby, Minnesota. It's located way up north in the Cuyuna Iron Range of the Lake Superior region. And in 1982, the mining industry left the area, taking with it jobs and, some people felt, the future. This town has found a new life and a new future from a surprising source. It's now home to 27 miles of world-class single-track trail for mountain bikes. And later in the hour, we'll talk about how bike trails have impacted communities in Iowa. But with me right now is Aaron Hautala, president of the Cuyuna Lakes Mountain Bike Crew. He visited Iowa last week to share his story with Think Iowa City. Hello, Aaron.
Hello. Thanks for having me on today.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And let's go back in time to when the mines shut down. They left behind kind of a wasteland. People were treating the landscape as a giant dump. People were leaving town. Mountain bikes were probably the last thing on anybody's mind. Where did this idea come from?
Yeah, I think at the time of the mines actually closing, mountain bikes hadn't been invented yet. Honestly, the industry is still that fresh. But when the last truck left with the dirt in the back, as we say, the economic heart was with it as well. And the mine land, if you will, remember it had the open pit mining. So there's these big piles of overburden that were of no use to the mine. So there's these big red piles everywhere of dirt. And when the little thing was on Mars taking pictures, if you remember what Mars looked like, I think that's what Cuyuna looked like back then. And it was left for anybody to do anything because the mining companies had no interest in it anymore because it provided no economics for them, that people were allowed to basically go in there and do whatever they want. And it turned into a negative opportunity, something you don't want to see in a community. Whether it was garbage or other illegal activities, that was becoming a destination for it and a well-known destination.
Right.
And that impacts a community where all of a sudden you had a Cuyuna in the mining era was probably one of the most glorious things there was because that area helped take the minerals out of the ground that did build America and also helped us get through two world wars. Imagine that kind of wow, glorious, and bam, done. And the people that, you know, could leave did, because they could find another job on the Mesabi Range or in Michigan. And then the brave-hearted stayed.
But it was a fairly small town even then. How large was Crosby at that time?
I don't know the exact numbers of what it was then. Today, at max, it's 4,000. And the kind of cool thing about it is they built all the towns right next to the mining area because people walk to work. So even today, now that the mine area has turned into a rec area, you're walking distance away from a huge rec area, kind of a benefit,
right?
You know, indirect. Never would have seen that one coming. Pretty cool.
So when did this idea for creating mountain bike trails in this sort of wasteland, when did that come about?
35 years ago, Barb Grove and her crew of women in the Cuyuna area, and Gloria Purpich was also part of that. And they didn't have mountain biking in mind 35 years ago because, again, I don't think the bikes were around. But they said, you know, this is our backyard. We're proud of it. And we cannot allow it to go into despair. The miners who worked here, that's a discredit to them. We will not accept that to be our future. And Barb, Gloria, and again, that large group of women rallied to Minnesota legislature, to the representative, to the senator, saying we want to turn this into a protected state rec area. And at the time, I think they probably looked at her as she was crazy. Like, why? But it took time. It took time. And she eventually was able to convince many of them to come up there. And the trees were growing again. The water had filled up these 400-foot holes to look like lakes. And all of a sudden, it looks like you have a mini Boundary Waters in the middle of Minnesota. And the state eventually told Barb Grove, okay, yes, we will do this, and put it into that Minnesota Cuyuna Country State Rec area, which basically protected it and gave it a DNR management over the top. And initially, they put in a boat landing for a lake, and that might have been it. That might have been the master vision. That might have been the entire program.
Which was still an improvement.
Major improvement from just having an unregulated landfill in
right.
your backyard, yeah. But then another group of community members had went to training at the Blandon Foundation, which again is a Minnesota foundation that helps communities re-engineer themselves. What are you going to create to be sustainable again. It's not okay for you to just sit there and look back. What are you going to do looking forward? And this group of people, now this is probably 15, 20 years ago, said, well, we, number one, need to get our residents, the people who live here, proud of their area again. We need to get them into the failed industrial land in a way that they say, wow, look how amazing it has become, so that they would take a negative and turn it into a positive. And the conduit they saw to do that was a paved trail. So they worked to get a paved trail, and it was about 6 miles of a paved trail just to get our local area, A, active, B, outside, C, wandering through what maybe was deemed as a wasteland and a very visual mark of failure and taking pride in it again. It's a very cool strategy to get things moving. And then that happened. That got put down. Still no national acclaim at that point because it was only
6 miles of paved
trail.
Yeah,
it's not enough to really break the world. But then a group out of the Twin Cities called the Minnesota Off-Road Cyclists, MORC for short, and then the International Mountain Bicycling Association, and a business called Quality Bicycle Products, QBP, they somehow learned about this Cuyuna, this thing, this opportunity, and they came up to our community just to tour it, and they were able to find these few residents that put the paved trail down and said, you know, those hills are perfect for this thing we call mountain biking. And at that point, the majority of our area probably never heard of what a mountain bike was, had no clue. And the cool thing about what our community did is listened. And it's so easy for a community when someone else comes in who sometimes gets branded an outsider or a stranger to say, well, go away. What do you know? But this group of residents said, well, tell us more. Because they saw an alignment between the groups of creating something that could, again, grow the pride of what it means to live in Cuyuna again. And through the process, they began to work on a new relationship, which eventually, years later, built the first 25 miles of trail, which set a new future in motion the day it opened. But it's such a cool story because I've been, even myself, involved in so many situations where someone from the outside comes in and says, hey, I got an idea. And for whatever reason, it's so easy to go,
yeah, what do you know?
I don't care.
Right.
You know, but I'm so thankful for the people that, A, came up, and B, that listened, because if neither would have happened, I wouldn't be sitting here with you today. There's no way. The story would not be there. The narrative would not be there. We'd have 6 miles of a paved trail. It'd be wonderful.
And but how did you get involved?
I got involved because I had been working with the region, because I own an ad agency. I'd been working with the Chamber pro bono to build up their identity, because I knew trails were coming. I never assumed they were going to be good. For some reason, I just assumed trails that you could ride, whoop-de-doo. But I said, well, we should still work on the identity of the region. It's pretty, could use some help. So we helped rebuild their identity, their website, all that stuff. And then my family, my wife, and our kids, we relocated to that area to live, to help start a church. And the trails opened. They had a huge parade, huge everything. They had like national celebrities that I'd never heard of because I wasn't out of the cycling industry come to town. And people rode, and I didn't. I didn't even ride for 2 months on these new trails when they opened. And then finally, 2 months in, a friend of mine, Steve Sullivan, says, Aaron, you really should ride these trails. They are pretty amazing. I'm like, oh, okay, I'll finally ride it. And then I rode them, and the rest is history. And what I didn't expect, what I never had a clue was coming, was the experience I had come to love in downhill skiing. And I would go out west. I'd go to Whistler. I'd go anywhere I could out west to ski. And that same experience was all of a sudden on a bicycle across the road from my house. And I said, this changes everything. And it turned into, from a casual observation, as to I'm going to do everything I can to maintain this where it is today and see if we can't grow this into being the best possible destination in the world. Because number one, I live here. And if you could have that where you live, why wouldn't you? Because I had this vision my whole life of, I want to live in the mountains. I want to live in the mountains. I want to live in the mountains. And what I came to years later was, I'm going to move the mountains. I'm going to move the mountains to Cuyuna. And yeah, we don't have mountains, but we're going to build that culture in the middle of Minnesota. And it's starting to show symptoms of it working, you know?
Well, let's talk about how it's changing the community. Because, I mean, mountain biking in and of itself is not this huge industry. It's not just that is a tourist attraction. You're changing the culture of this town. So tell me how this works.
Well, the first part is just the positivity. And that's hard to re-engineer, if you will. But when there was the success of a cycling thing and there was something new to do, people started coming. And it took, honestly, years for people to really believe that this could do something. And when the trails opened, I would say locally there was far more people that were skeptical than were on the bandwagon trying to push it forward. But over time, they kept seeing these people come and these people loving their town for what it was and their people loving their history for what it was. And the region, through the years of failure, had kind of positioned themselves as a failure. But to have someone come to you and say, "This is pretty cool what you got here," you look at yourself differently. You're like, "Really? You think so? You think this?" And you take more pride in your backyard. And what I've seen from, because I moved over there 6 years ago and months before the trails opened. So I was able to see what the town was like before the trails officially opened. And I can see what they're like today. And if there's one thing that's different than anything, is there a positivity on Main Street. And that doesn't mean everyone's in the same boat. That doesn't mean everyone's slapping on the back saying good job. It just means there's a belief that we can make it happen again.
That instead there's a future.
Instead of being stuck and being okay with where it was stuck and saying that's all we can be, that's all we're supposed to be, that's all we'll ever be, there was this thing of there's no limit to what we could be. And that for me is inspiring because I have a hard time just hanging out in status quo and thinking that's okay. And again, that's not the whole community. That's not every resident. But you can feel it. People come outside of their shops and look around and say, "So what's new today?" And that's what's actually happened. There's enough changing and new businesses coming in where if you don't, like everyone who went to Cuyuna last year from Iowa, which there's a lot. We love Iowa. Iowa loves us. We sincerely love Iowa. But everyone who went there last year to this year, it's a completely different Main Street.
And we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Aaron Hautala. He is president of the Cuyuna Lakes Mountain Bike Crew. And he came to Iowa to share his story about how 27 miles of world-class single-track mountain bike trail has really transformed the community of Crosby, Minnesota. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about bike trails. Specifically, at the moment, we're talking about 27 miles of world-class single-track trail for mountain bikes built in northern Minnesota in the Cuyuna Iron Range of the Lake Superior region on land that had been left behind by the mining industry near Crosby, Minnesota. And with me is Aaron Hautala. He is president of the Cuyuna Lakes Mountain Bike Crew, and he visited Iowa to share his story of that community, those trails with Think Iowa City. And Aaron, just before the break, we were talking about how this has changed the town. And you talked about how people are much more positive, looking toward the future. This is a town now with a future. Now, let's talk about economics. You have tourists coming to town, but it's not just the tourism industry that has benefited this area economically. I mean, we talk a lot about how small town Iowa loses young people all the time. This has kind of changed that trajectory for Crosby, Minnesota, right? You have younger people who actually want to be there.
Yeah, not only from the Main Street entrepreneur who showed up, and there's now a handful of people who never lived there before who moved here to start a business to make it happen, but even more importantly, and when you look at traditional economics, I think this point is missed. But you as a community in outstate Iowa or outstate Minnesota have to recruit to be successful as a community the best educators, K-12, the best engineers for your manufacturing, and the best doctors and surgeons for whatever healthcare you have. And if you can't do that, you as a community will start to go down the downward spiral because you'll have no relevance to why someone would want to live there. Because if you don't have a good school, I'm not going to put my kid in your school. If you don't have good healthcare, I really don't want to be next to you. And that's the healthcare and school are everything to a community. And due to these trails, and we have the case studies and the sound bites and the letters to prove it, Crosby Ironton Public Schools was able to fill a tremendous, like over 12 positions that they had to recruit for new teachers because they had a major wave of retirement for teachers that had been there. And the first thing they did when they had a recruit that they really wanted was brought him to the great outdoors and said, you have this in your backyard every day. This is your quality of life benefit. Forget whatever the work is. You work, but this is what you get after it. And the same thing with the doctors and surgeons. I mean, the doctors and surgeons are picking to practice in outstate Minnesota, being trained at the Mayo Clinic. They get trained at the Mayo Clinic. They probably could go anywhere they want in Minnesota or Iowa or the country, but they're picking to go in small town America because it's small. They like that. There's a quality of life, quality work life, but they have the best possible outdoor recreation amenity in their backyard.
So is there, are there ripples to the other communities in the area as well?
Yeah, there is. Even Brainerd. Brainerd's like the tourism hub of Minnesota because it's 2 hours north of Minneapolis, St. Paul. Madden's, Grandview, Breezy Point Resort, Cragans, major resorts, traditional resorts over there. And they are now seeing their guests. They're taking, I think Madden's is taking 700 guests over to Cuyuna a year to give them a new experience, in not in place of the traditional resort experience, but as an addition to. And when you think about resorting, you know, the new generation, the 20-year-olds, aren't going to do what their grandparents did. They're not going to find the same enjoyment. So now with Cuyuna, the Brainerd area is able to get the grandparent, the parent, and the grandkid all having fun in the same area and wanting to go there. And it's all in tourism talking. It's all about getting one more person to come up every year and staying one extra day. And Cuyuna now allows all of our main tourism kind of companies at least to have one more day of people staying in their properties.
So I want to broaden this conversation out because obviously there are a lot of people who are really excited about what you've done way up north. And in Iowa, we've been working for a long time. At least some people have been working hard to make Iowa a bicycling destination. And that movement has been going on for decades. The Rails to Trails movement started in the 1980s. And the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation has been instrumental in building and partnering on many of Iowa's bike trails. Andrea Bolton is also here with us, Trails and Greenways Director for the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. Hello, Andrea.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And as I mentioned, I mean, there has been this movement afoot in Iowa to build bike trails for decades. I mean, in thinking about what happened in Crosby, Minnesota, Iowa has taken, in many ways, a much bigger view of biking. Of course, we're talking about road biking for the most part, not mountain biking. But there's been a movement to make the whole state a great place to come and bike.
Absolutely. We've been working hard to try to make Iowa the world capital of trails. I'm primarily looking at that at all kinds of trails, but the work that I do here with the foundation is with multi-use trails. So you're biking, jogging, rollerblading, hiking trails.
So primarily, where has the push been? We've talked about, you know, rail to trail. There are a lot of trails that are sort of the crushed rock surface. In recent years, it seems like I've seen a lot more trails being built that are paved. Where do you feel the emphasis is right now?
I think that a lot of communities are looking at how do they develop those paved trails because of the variety of uses that come with those. You can have your road bikes on them. You can have your rollerblades on them. You can have your strollers and what have you on them, and it allows for a smoother ride. I was thinking as you guys were talking earlier in the segment about how these trails are reviving the communities. Really, the rail trail movement started that trail development across Iowa because it provided that kind of ready-made route, that ready-made corridor to do something with. But as things have come along, we're seeing that there may not be that rail corridor available, but there's still that demand for a trail in communities. So it's been kind of inspiring to see all across the state what communities are doing to bring that quality of life amenity to their town.
Can you give me an example of a community in Iowa that has really invested a lot in trails and really seen kind of a culture shift because of it?
So I was earlier this morning, I was looking at some of the projects that had gone after grant funding last year. And really, almost every community across the state is trying to do something at some level locally there. But a great example that I can point to, and one that many have heard of time and again, is the High Trestle Trail in central Iowa. The High Trestle Trail connects 9 different jurisdictions, counties, and communities, and is about 24, 25 miles long. But you look at when the railroad, Union Pacific, decided that they were no longer going to be in those communities. When the railroad leaves, that generally means that there are customers that are also leaving. And so that can really leave a town feeling abandoned and confused and worried about what's going to happen next. And these communities, Woodward, Madrid, Slater, really took this opportunity to use the trail as a catalyst to reinvest in their communities. And that's everything from, as Aaron was mentioning, that community pride and that positivity of this may not be the silver bullet that brings life back into our community, but it's going to be a start. And with that, those communities saw new restaurants, new bed and breakfasts, new bike shops, ice cream parlors. And as people came to visit their communities to ride the trail, they're also spending a little bit more time in those downtowns and exploring the culture and the history and what those communities had to offer. And I you know, now I see those communities show up at tourism expos, and they're really doing a lot more to promote themselves as a destination in themselves.
And as you said, this may not be the silver bullet. Aaron, I'd love to get advice from you, because I'm sure that when people get excited about building a trail in a community, there are some people that do start to feel like this will fix everything.
Right.
and of course, it's not going to be the silver bullet. And obviously, some of these communities have really embraced these trails, have individuals have stepped forward and really taken advantage of these opportunities as entrepreneurs, and that enriches the culture. What advice would you give to people in a community when one of these trails is being built, as they move forward, to look at it as a realistic opportunity, not just as something that's going to fix all the problems
right.
of a small town?
Yeah, it's definitely not a silver bullet, and we never tried to paint it that way in Cuyuna. We did paint it as a silver magnet, though, that mm-hmm. these trails are magnetic to draw the right people to your town that can build the infrastructure forward. In traditional economic development, where I would struggle with them 6 years ago, was, well, why would we invest in that? It could never pay a $70,000 paying job. You know, that tourism, it's nice, but it's dessert. I said, you're looking at it the wrong way. If people don't want to come to a town, they will never, ever put their business there. And we can't start in Cuyuna by recruiting the huge business with 300 employees at $80,000 a year unless that owner said, I can guarantee my 300 employees want to live here. I said, we have to start small to get big. And we're going to start small, but in quality of life. And then it'll rebuild Main Street, much like we've both said. And when you've rebuilt Main Street to be vibrant and exciting, where a potential business owner could say, you know what? I think my employees would be really happy living here. Then you'll get there. And if you do it the other way around, it'll be a flash in the pan, or it'll never work at all. And I've seen that over and over again. It's like you have to build from the bottom up and start small to get big. And then you're sustainable, too.
Andrea, I want to ask you, these trails, people rave about trails. If they live near one, they drive to take their bikes somewhere. Although I do hear a lot of people sharing a lot of concerns about the bikeability of our roads in Iowa, because these trails go from one place to another, but you have to get to the trail, or, you know, the trail isn't necessarily connected to another trail. Is that a stumbling block? Is that a big challenge? Because our roads are not safe.
Well, I think that's one thing all trail planners and bike ped planners are looking at, is that we can't just build trails. There's a whole system that needs to be improved, and that's whether it's putting bike lanes on roads or creating shareable roadways. it's part of a bigger structure, a part of a bigger system. And I know that the Iowa Bicycle Coalition here in Iowa has been doing a tremendous job and a lot of work to improve the safety of our roads. And that's one thing that I think it would be very valuable for all of us in the state in our communities to continue to look at, because trails are expensive to build and they take time. It's a long process to get something developed. And then the work just doesn't stop with once the pavement is poured. There's still a lot of work you need to do to make sure people are aware of what you have in your communities. But if we can continue to work together with the system and improve our roadways and take advantage of what we have infrastructure-wise, that process becomes a little bit easier. And I will say one of the benefits Iowa has, and if we can create a culture of safe on-street riding, Iowa is a grid system of low volume, low traffic, low speed roads because of the way that we've been established as a farming agricultural state. All these farm-to-market roads are paved in low volume. And those that aren't paved, one of the big things that we're seeing on rising up is just the idea of gravel riding and fat tire bikes going on gravel. And we've got just as much gravel road miles as we do anything else. And if we can create a culture that embraces those and create a culture that can make people feel safe riding on the road, then Iowa is going to move forward leaps and bounds with the amount of opportunities we can offer people to not only ride on our trails but connect to the other trails via those low-volume, low-speed roads.
I want to ask both of you, because I'm sure this is relevant up in Minnesota as well. Sometimes there's a little bit of push and pull between the people in these small towns that may be next to this recreation area or, have an old rail thoroughfare that can be turned into a trail, and the people from larger urban areas that may be some of the primary people to travel to those communities. I mean, Andrea, do you encounter conflict between urban and rural mindsets?
I think initially it can be scary or unnerving to have something come into your community that is unfamiliar to you, and there can be some pushback. But ultimately, in my experience, what I've seen is once those trails are established and used, the communities really come together and rally behind them. I'm thinking of a trail in Hamilton County, and it's a small trail that connects two different communities, Jewell and Aylesworth. And along that corridor, there was a site of this former rail corridor that was basically being used as a dumping area. But the community came together as they were developing those trails and cleaned that area up and really invested in it and, established more community pride. And I think that's what these rural areas and these individuals that may be a little nervous or hesitant about a trail and all of these spandex riders coming into their area see is that you, one, it's not all spandex riders. It's families coming to your community and eating at your local diners. And two, it's more eyes on the ground. There are more people out there enjoying your community. And the more people that are out there, the less likely anything illegal or destructive is happening. And they come around to that. And we've seen adjacent landowners on trails actually start to help out and be volunteer members who are doing maintenance and mowing and clearing, helping cyclists who may have flats and offering up their, parts of their land for camping or rest stops. So I think just like anything else, there may be some hesitancy with something new, but ultimately we're seeing that in the end, everyone can see the benefit, or most people can see the benefit and jump on board.
And we'd have just a few seconds left, Erin. You talked about people being open to ideas from the outside. Obviously, that's worked really well for Crosby. Has there been conflict as well?
There's always conflict. Yeah, it's there every day. But your role as a leader is to always paint the picture and to bring alignment to it no matter what you're faced with. And that's what we've always done. We have that master vision to be the international year-round family cycling destination, and things happen.
Even in the winter?
Yeah, we can own winter. We're in Minnesota. We got 10 out of 12 months our winter. That's what we do. We love it. That's why we live there. But no, conflict is normal. And if you don't have it, something's wrong. You should be there a little bit.
All right. Well, we are out of time, but thank you both so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having
me.
Aaron Howdala is president of the Cayona Lakes Mountain Bike Crew up in Crosby, Minnesota. We've been talking about their incredible mountain bike trails up there and what that has done for the community. Andrea Bolton is Trails and Greenways Director for the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I have interviewed a lot of people who run community-supported agriculture farms, or CSAs, over the years. But the homestead is unique. It's a farm and a CSA that produces sustainably grown produce, but the emphasis isn't really on that. It's on creating a life and a future for the people who grow that produce. The farm is a residential facility for adults who are on the autism spectrum, a facility that also provides the residents with meaningful work and helps them develop life skills. Angela Book-Glynn is one of the directors at the homestead. She is with me now. Hello, Angela.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
And let's go back in time. The homestead has been around now for about 22 years. How did this idea come about?
We really had a very grassroots beginning. Parents were concerned about the future for their adult children. This was a time when there was not a lot of options, and certainly not a lot of options for people on the autism spectrum disorder. So this group got together and really wanted to have some type of home for their adult children besides a institutional type setting. And so this group of professionals got together and created a new living and working opportunity for adults with autism.
So it was designed from the very start to be a residential facility, but where did the farming come in? Because I can understand looking for a different kind of group living situation for people on the autism spectrum. Why farming?
This group, they researched other programs around the country, and they were seeking out experts in the field of autism. This included Bittersweet Farms in White House, Ohio, and the Carolina Living and Learning Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Bittersweet Farms obviously had a farm and also worked exclusively with people with autism. And so we patterned our facility somewhat in the way that they had a very successful program.
And in patterning the program after that facility, what was it about farming and that program that was so attractive?
The farm provides a person with autism an opportunity to learn some work skills that they may not be quite ready for in the community. Many people with autism have a lot of sensory issues, crowds, things of that nature are very difficult. And so this allows a person served to go out and learn work skills alongside an autism associate who's specifically trained in autism in a safe environment where we can take breaks when we need to, but we're still learning all of those type of skills that will take you to your next phase in your life.
The facility is a living facility. So how many people are living there right now?
At the farm, at the campus setting, we have 24 adults who live there on our 77-acre farm, where we actually use 7 acres of that farmland for growing our fruits and vegetables, and then we have 2 additional acres of apple trees. So 24 people live there, and then we have in our adult community services a group of gentlemen who come out and work the farm as well.
All right, so there are more people who are involved in the farm than just the people who live there. And how does somebody qualify to live there?
You need to have a diagnosis of autism, as we are exclusively working with people with autism.
And what is the living situation like? If someone moves into this facility, what's the environment like?
It's a beautiful environment. It's a country setting. We have 6 4-bedroom homes on the grounds, and so you have your own room, a nice living room, just like you or I would have in our own home, and then we have 24-hour staff to provide support to them.
The people who live there, can you give me an idea of an age range and genders?
Currently, we have 20 males who live there and 4 women. Our age range is from 18 to our oldest resident is 70.
And how long have people been living there? And this has been around for 22 years. Are there some people who have lived at this facility for that entire time?
Yes, there definitely is. We have some of our original residents who came when the doors opened. I would say at least half of those individuals. This is their country home.
Well, I want to bring Ashley Bunnell into the conversation as well. She is an autism associate who works at the Homestead. And with me, as I mentioned before, Angela Bookglen, one of the directors at the Homestead. Hello, Ashley.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And let's talk about what a day looks like at the Homestead. You can both chime in. And Ashley, I know that your work starts a little bit later after breakfast time. So why don't you start us out, Angela? How is the day structured?
Our day is structured with the individuals. They come to work in the cab or on a bus, and then they greet Ashley, and they're always so happy to see her. So I let Ashley take it from there with helping them clock in and starting the process of their day.
Well, and you mentioned people coming to the facility. I was talking about the people who live there. How do they start their day before their working day?
During the morning routine, they're doing just like you and I would do. They're fixing their breakfast. They're doing their morning hygiene and routines, just whatever household chores need to be done to get started for their day. And then they'll come up, and we'll have specifically chosen tasks for those individuals based on their strengths. So if I have someone who's really, really good at weeding and likes that beginning and end of a row, then they're going to come out, they're going to have their assignment, and they're going to start working alongside their autism associate to help them. If I have somebody who's really good at cleaning and loves water and those type of things, then I'm going to have them come out, and they're going to clean pots. So it's very based on just the strengths of that person and what task is best for them.
All right, Ashley, pick us up. So it's time to start work. How does this go?
Well, they're here for like 4 hours, and they come in at 8 and they leave at noon. We get them clocked in, and then we're outside. You know, we're seeding in the greenhouse, we're planting right now out in the field and harvesting everything by hand. So it's just all those hands, you know, we're teaching them how, you know, teamwork. We all have to work together, and they need a lot of encouragement because it's hard work, you know. It's like, you know, gardening, getting down in the dirt, you know, and it's fun. I mean, I think they have fun when they're out there too.
Now, the work is difficult. Angela mentioned trying to gear it toward people's particular strengths or particular interests. Are there some things that really make farming really perfect work, perhaps, for someone who's on the autism spectrum? Is there something that makes this kind of an ideal task?
It really does. People with autism are very comfortable with routine and predictability. So when you think about farm work, it is very predictable in that there's the natural change of the seasons. So a person sort of knows what you're going to be doing in spring. They know come fall they're going to be harvesting. We also do, in the winter, we grow poinsettias and live wreaths. They know they're going to be in the greenhouse during the winter months. So we're a year-round operation. But I think just the predictability of knowing this is what you do during the seasons is perfect. Another great option for the farm life versus the office life, many people with autism, as I mentioned earlier, have sensory issues. Fluorescent lights, the hum of the air conditioner, all of those type of things can be incredibly distracting for someone. On the farm setting, you have sunshine for your lighting. You have breeze and wind for your air conditioning. And it's amazing to see how that environment can help somebody succeed.
the growing season is obviously the busy season when you work on the farm. Ashley, what do you do during the off season, during the winter?
Well, during the winter, we have those poinsettias. We grow poinsettias in the greenhouse, and then we make live wreaths for Christmas. And then after that, we just kind of clean up, you know, and get stuff ready for, you know, the upcoming big season, you know. There's a lot that has to be done to prepare.
And you've been with the homestead for about 2 years, right?
Yep.
And each day you spend your day with a crew of about four people. Has it been the same four people the entire time?
It has. Yep.
How long have they been involved with the homestead?
About 8 years. They've worked there. So, and then there was another one that came in about halfway through my first year. So he hasn't been there for quite that long. And he's going to be leaving us soon because, you know, during his time here, he's, you know, he has more confidence and he's going to go to school. So he decided he was going to go to school.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool.
Now, in addition to working on the farm and getting that work done, because these are people on the autism spectrum, you're also working with them to help them develop social skills so maybe they can go on to another challenge. How does that work into the work that you're doing?
That's the big thing. there's one individual who's a naturally very shy person. Like, he barely would talk. And in the past year, he is talking. He's authoritative, even like a way, you know, he's using his voice, his strong voice, you know, is what I want to call it. And he just, you can tell he really loves being outside and he loves the vegetables. He loves what he's doing, his job. You know, he's proud of himself and, you know, his confidence has just like grown so much. And it's just been such a wonderful experience, like watching that happen, you know, and just being a part of it, you know.
Well, and becoming an expert in what he's doing, working with people reliably, that routine, that security, I can understand how that would help anyone thrive. Are there specific things that you try to do to facilitate those interactions?
Yes, I'm a very encouraging, like positive person, and I try to just say, when they come in, we're going to have a good day. You know, we're going to have a great day, and we have good music playing, and it's like I try to make it be more fun, you know, because it can be like a mundane kind of task, you know, planting and over and over and over and over again, you know. But I think they kind of like that, mm-hmm. you know, because they know what they're doing. You know, they know I'm going to plant this and then go on, and it's not changing all the time. It's just, I don't know.
Routine and predictability,
yeah.
For sure. And Angela, because this is a communal living situation, having roommates can be challenging for everyone. For mm-hmm. someone without strong social skills, I can see that being particularly challenging. Mm-hmm. How do you help people in the facility live together?
We have individualized program and plans for people. We teach a lot of coping skills. We work very hard to also allow as much choice as possible. We're going to accommodate if, you know, you want to not have to sit next to this person at the dinner table. You're not going to have to sit next to that table at that table. You know, it's not a institute. It's their home. And so we do everything we can to make it feel like your home, and that you have choices and you have a life to live.
Do you have to help people settle disputes?
Occasionally, yes. Mm-hmm. We do have some challenging behaviors. In the intermediate care facility, level of care is the highest level of care. And so we may have some of the most challenging people on the spectrum disorder who live there. And that's part of our job, is to watch people grow and help them through that phase in their life and teach them those skills to be able to calm themselves.
Now, I think back to the early 90s, and so much has been learned about autism since the early 90s. We've also had many more people diagnosed with autism since the early 90s. There's been huge leaps forward in opportunities for education in the public schools for children with autism. Mm-hmm. When working with adults on the autism spectrum, is it difficult to find other people who have had success and had done this kind of research and figured out what does help adults?
It is difficult. Research right now is primarily focused on the children, which is wonderful. But that is definitely the emphasis, is the world of working with kiddos. So I would agree, yes, that can be difficult to find that. But we also have clinics throughout the state of Iowa, in Altoona, Clive, Hiawatha, Davenport, Cedar Falls. And although they work with children, these are highly trained and educated staff that are providing applied behavior analysis in a one-to-one setting. Sometimes even a 2-to-1 ratio. And we're going to collaborate with the entire agency as a whole to learn those skills and see how we can apply those into our residential sites.
Is it difficult to find funding? I mean, I'm guessing that the CSA doesn't pay for itself. This is a very high-level facility.
Right. We're funded through Medicaid and the managed care organizations is how our agency receives its funding.
And is it difficult to get enough funding?
Well, in this day and age right now, funding is all kind of up in the air, as most of us know. So it's an uncertain time for agencies everywhere. And so, with the farm, all of the CSA revenue that comes in goes right back into the farm to help it remain sustainable. Those help pay the wages to the person served.
Now, you mentioned earlier, Ashley, that one of the people that you work with is going to go back to school, moving on to other things. Is there an opportunity that some of the people who live in this facility can move on and live independently? And now that they have employment skills as well, go to work?
Oh, yes, there is. It's good for them, to have a change. You know, I think that could possibly help their lives, flourish even more, just having that change and moving from that area and moving on. And yeah, there's a couple of people that might be doing that soon.
And is there a long waiting list to get into the homestead?
We do have a waiting list. As you mentioned earlier, the diagnosis is just rising incredibly fast. The current statistic is 1 in 68 children are diagnosed with autism. So there's a huge need.
Well, we're out of time, but Angela Bookland, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ashley Bunnell, thank you.
Thanks.
Angela Bookland is one of the directors at the Homestead. Ashley Bunnell is an autism associate with the Homestead, which is a farm and residential living facility for adults with autism, an opportunity for them to do meaningful work and gain skills that would allow them to do meaningful work elsewhere as well. The Homestead is located in Altoona. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. The program is produced by Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. You can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. I'm on Twitter as well, @CharityNebby. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.